It's Patriots Week, and there are an awful lot of things to be feeling patriotic about. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
It's great to be back with you, Barry, again here on the air, talking to the people out there in radio and podcast land. We always like creating a new show. Now, last week, what I did was I took a show. I kind of decided that what we needed to do was a retrospective. So I took a show from virtually exactly a year ago. Now, of course, the dates didn't exactly match because Saturday a year ago wasn't the same date as Saturday this year. But nonetheless, I went back to the archives to a year ago, and I just basically put together that show so you could hear what we were talking about in 2016. I think it's always good to go back a year and find out what we were discussing. And of course, what do you think?
How wrong we were on things. Yeah.
What do you think we were discussing in April of 2016?
I think we were probably discussing the recently passed Ohio primary. We were discussing the chances of Trump being the nominee.
Well,
am I getting warm?
Yeah, and we were discussing the upcoming Republican convention. And yes. I will give a mea culpa because I predicted that Trump would not be the nominee on that show. So guess what? I was wrong.
You and about 95% of the rest of the political talking head.
Well, I'll be quite honest. I was convinced it was going to be stolen.
Yeah, well, you know, it was. They tried to create a rump group about three blocks away. Remember, that's where John Kasich went to for partying.
Okay, you and I know what that was about. We've talked about it on the air, and I'll still say it to this day. What was supposed to happen was the convention was supposed to not nominate on the first ballot, go into a deadlock, and then John Kasich would step in and be the savior of the party and come in and agree to be the liberal Republican banner holder and take us all to victory over Hillary Clinton by espousing virtually the same platform that she was espousing. And therefore, we were going to fight it out over the middle ground, and essentially all us conservatives would all hold our nose and vote for Kasich because, after all, he couldn't possibly be worse than Hillary when there were those of us who knew that he could possibly be as bad as Hillary. That was the scenario. He was not going to attend in hopes that the convention would beg him to come and take the mantle. And, of course, as we all know, Trump won overwhelmingly on the first ballot. So, oops, that strategy backfired. Are we shocked? A lot of John Kasich's strategies have been backfiring lately. I'd say that John Kasich's second term has been nothing more or less than a string of unremitting strategy backfires. I'm not sure he can get anything right at this point because his worldview has become so warped.
Yeah, it's hard to say. But, you know, the governor's facing his own interesting set of problems right now. We move up the clock a little bit over a year later. And that's the fact that, well, he's still sitting in Ohio as governor, not sitting in the White House or sitting as I could have been the president and the cards just didn't play out right. And Hillary's now sitting in there, but Hillary's protecting my Medicaid expansion money. See, John's been making an awful lot of trips to the Hill to try to protect Medicaid expansion money. Why? Well, just this little piece that happened last week, Chuck, and I'm sorry that we didn't get a chance to actually record a regular broadcast last week. Because there was a press conference that was held at the State House, Chuck. I think I talked to you about it. And it was the governor. And it was his director of the Office of Budget and Management. It was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. It was the Senate President. I don't know if the House and Senate finance chairs were there, but they probably should have been. Because it was a press conference to announce the fact that as the House is working on the governor's budget proposal, they are going to have to cut $400 million per year of that biennium, or $800 million over the two-year budget, because Ohio's revenues are not coming in as expected. Yeah, that's right. You're hearing that sucking sound that Ross Perot talked about.
The giant sucking sound, yeah.
That giant sucking sound, as Ross Perot predicted, because the bottom is about to fall out of Ohio's Ponzi scheme of an economy. Now, I'm not saying that the folks who are out there working in our economy, the business owners and the manufacturers and the job producers, that that's the Ponzi scheme. No, the Ponzi scheme was the, we can continue to spend at government levels that are every year setting a new bar for raising spending, acting like we're being conservative, and then whistling past the graveyard and wondering why everybody's screaming that the train's about to go off the tracks. Well, guess what? It's coming home to roost, Chuck. You've got a situation right now where they're realizing that people were right. Those people who were saying, this isn't sustainable, this isn't sustainable, guess what? It's not sustainable.
Well, of course it
isn't. So what's Casey doing other than the one or two days that he dropped in to say, hey guys, well, we got to cut the budget. I'm sorry, the money that I thought was going to be there isn't going to be there, so I can't spend as much as I want to spend. So you guys are responsible for finding out how to cut $400 million a year. Now, it's funny, Chuck, because last night, we're recording this on Wednesday on the 19th, on actually Patriots Day, and we'll get into that in a minute. But last night, I had the chance to sit and talk with the chair of the Health and Human Services Subcommittee of the House Finance Committee. We were both in an event together with our friends, the Ridge Project, celebrating all their work. And we got to talking, and he said, we're submitting back to the committee $300 million in cuts. He goes, we found $300 million to cut in just our part of the budget. He goes, we submit that back. We don't know where it's going to land. But he goes, that's three quarters of what we need just for the 1 year. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's actually only the $150 million of each year of the biennium. You still have to cut $250 million in each year somewhere else. But the point is that they're working on it, and the House had already been in a position where they weren't going to necessarily just accept the governor's proposal, because they realized it was irresponsible. The biggest way it's irresponsible, Chuck, he's balancing the vast majority of these spending increases and the balancing of his budget on Medicaid expansion money. And as we're seeing and hearing from the Hill, that probably won't hold up and be there much longer.
Almost for sure not. I mean, essentially, look, the whole healthcare thing is falling in on itself, and it has been falling in on itself. Well, it's what? It got passed in 2010. It's been caving in since about 2012 or so. It's gotten really bad in the last 4 years. Nobody wants to talk about it. When you see the co-ops all collapsing, companies withdrawing from them, saying basically we don't want to play. We can't offer healthcare plans at any kind of a decent price where anybody would buy them, by offering full coverage for any condition and no exceptions for pre-existing conditions. I warned people of this. I've been warning people of this for the last 20 years, and I keep saying, you guys don't know how to do math. You cannot cover every condition, no pre-existing conditions, and have it not cost a king's ransom money. What you have to do is essentially set up panels who decide who gets treatment and who doesn't. That was Sarah Palin's infamous death panels.
Right. Well, and it wasn't her death panels. It was the panels that they found in the version of the Affordable Care Act that was going to be passed before. And, of course, they were still in there. They're still in there.
But it was a millstone they hung around her neck and basically tried to say that she was lying about it. Well, obviously, she's not lying about it. I mean, those things started popping up. If you were 76 years old and got cancer, you weren't going to get treatment.
Nope.
Bottom line, you'll get palliative care.
Yep, pretty much.
And that is a death panel, because there are people that can beat cancer and live into their 90s. But we don't want to play that because they're not productive anymore. They're not really contributing to the tax base, which is the bottom line. Now, what's that say about it? That's essentially treating people like cattle. You know, when cows stop giving milk or they're beyond their peak to be beef cattle.
Yep.
You send them to the yard.
You do.
And that's exactly what we're talking about here. That person's value is based on how much revenue they can generate, not on their worth to their families and their children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews and things and their friends at church, their church family. They're just not worth anything. Let me tell you something. Some of the richest relationships you can have are with the elderly in your church, because they have so much to tell you. And yet, these are the people that the healthcare advocates would sweep under the rug.
Right, right. And, you know, we've been fighting that for a while, everything from the medical orders bill to death panels to now we're pushing a situation of palliative care where basically it's like we're going to encourage people to go into palliative care. In other words, instead of actually taking care of them and trying to heal them,
right,
we're just going to say, well, you know, your time's up. Why don't you just go on over here and just do your thing and live out the last few days that we're going to let you have before you die.
Yeah, that's basically it. We're going to make your dying days as comfortable as possible. That's a sad way to do it, but that's kind of a segue on what we were talking about, because essentially there's a gigantic hole in the budget, and most of it is can be placed directly on the doorstep of John Kasich's expansion of Medicaid in his preparation to run for president.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's coming home to roost, and so that's what we're looking at right now is to figure out how we fix that problem. But, you know, again, Kasich would rather have been sitting in D.C. messing around with either himself being president, trying to expand and throw more money so it would hide the fact that the budget was never going to come out correctly, or conversely, sitting there having chats with Hillary Clinton about how much more money that they're going to get as tax base went up on everybody else from the federal level. Chuck, it's a right royal blue mess, but it's a mess that John Kasich's going to have to sit here and live with as he goes into his last year and a half here now. I mean, basically, we are just a little over a year out from the gubernatorial primary for 2018.
Right.
Kasich's termed out. He's not going to be running for that. But the point is that he's going to have to sit there and probably hear the Republican front runner, whoever that might be, beat him up about his budget.
Yeah.
You know, in order to make some promises to get people to vote for them. It's going to be very interesting to see how this all turns out.
Well, and it looks to me, honestly, like he's trying to keep something alive, the possibility of running for Senate in 2018.
I think there's a possibility, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I think those chances are swirling the bowl right now.
Yes, you have to believe that because you cannot. I mean, he's already admitting that they basically weren't making correct projections. They don't really have a handle on what's going on in the economy. When you send a budget to legislators that grows spending by over 6% over the biennium, and then you have to walk it back because, well, hey, oops, we're not going to have that money. This is a problem. That's what Kasich's dealing with. That's what he's going to have to deal with. But again, this is also, and this is the way I say it, Chuck, in every situation, there's both danger and opportunity. Well, the opportunity here is this part of this celebration of Patriots Day, is that we can go back in and say, okay, guys, it isn't tax cuts that have caused this budget hole. It's the incredibly increased spending that Kasich seems to want to engage in order to make happy certain pockets of special interests, more specifically in areas like what he did during his last gubernatorial run by pumping bunches of money up into Cleveland to get Cleveland to A, swing more his direction with votes, and B, for the party powers that be to hand him a goofball like Ed Fitzgerald as an opponent. That was a good investment on Kasich's part.
Well,
but his problem now is it's again, and if they go about trying to say we're going to pare back these tax cuts or these tax reductions or indexing the income taxes in order to drop people into lower brackets, they're making a big mistake because that's how you stimulate growth in your economy. How you kill growth in your economy is expanding entitlement programs and spending more money, and that's exactly what John Kasich's been doing. So if he would just have given the tax cuts and let those settle and figure out where we were going to be, he probably would have found out that, you know, and it wouldn't have taken one budget cycle, maybe it takes two, but that your revenues would start coming back in because there's more. If you have more manufacturing, you have more job creation, you have more people paying income taxes. You have more people paying income taxes, even at lower levels. Do the math, Chuck. I mean, if we drop
You're
the
right.
levels 5%, but we pick up 20% growth in the economy, that's a net increase in revenues coming to the government. It falls together.
This is the myth of the...
But they're not there.
Yeah. Well, look, this is the myth of the top 1% aren't paying their fair share. Honestly, the tax burden is always on the backs of the middle class. Always, 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 always. Why? because there aren't that many people in the 1%. Hence the name. In the top 10%, where something like 40 or 50% of the revenue come from, there just aren't that many of them. Okay? Now, you could raise rates. I can probably dig up something on Tucker Carlson from the last couple of days ago where he had a liberal professor on talking about raising the top rate to 70%. Look, we've done that already. We've been through that. What did it do? Well, it sent us into one of the worst recessions we've had. How did we fix it? We made the top rate, I think, at the time. What was the top rate that on the tax cuts in 82? 82 or 83. It was something like 31%, and it got raised to 39% with TEFRA, which was a huge mistake. And the economy immediately felt it in a negative sense, and yet we didn't go back to the 31% bracket. At one point in this country, I think we had a 78% bracket, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be, and if I am, you can feel free to correct me, but I'm pretty sure we had a 78% bracket. And it wasn't that much money to be making to get in that bracket. But what does that do? That kills incentive for investment. I mean, it kills incentive to employ people. Look, one of the things that has killed off employment in Ohio is Obamacare, is expanded Medicaid, is all these things that are tied up. People keep saying, well, expanded Medicaid isn't Obamacare. Yes, it is. It's part and parcel of it. And the fact is, it's killed it off because, Barry, what happens when an employer, which I am one, goes out and looks at what it costs to employ bring in a new employee? If I bring someone in and pay them what amounts to today a rather small salary, $35,000 a year, is $35,000 a year actually what it costs my corporations to employ that person?
No.
How much do you suppose it probably costs? I mean, I've sat down and done rough calculations on what it would cost.
Basically, I think the going number is like 1.8 to 1.9 times the salary.
It's almost double.
Yeah, almost double, yeah.
Yeah, so in order to employ someone at $35,000 a year, I got to come up with $70,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Because people don't seem to understand, you know, when I've talked to younger people about this, they don't grasp it. I'm like, okay, do you understand? I have to pay half the Medicaid, half the Social Security. I have to offer a health care benefit that's going to cost a huge amount of money, depending on how many family members of this person at $35,000 a year is going to have. And if I don't have it, then I got to pay a fine anyway.
Right.
That's a significant portion of that amount. So there are other costs, unemployment insurance. There's costs like workman's compensation that I got to pay. All these fees, taxes, every time I do something, I have to pay someone a fee. You know, Newt Gingrich is sort of the author at the federal level of no longer creating budget items to run agencies in the federal government. They run on fees. And Barry, you and I ran into this from someone we knew in the Department of Commerce who came in and thumped his chest and told us, we don't take any tax money. We operate on fees, user fees. Well, who pays user fees to the Department of Commerce, Barry?
Businesses
pay the fees. And what is a fee in reality?
It's a tax.
So we said, look, that's an absurdity. That's like taking your wallet out of your right hand pocket and putting it in your left hand pocket. It doesn't change a thing. A fee is a tax. And he was adamant that their agency did not take tax money. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry to tell you, but a fee is a tax. If I have to pay it to remain in business under penalty of jail or fine or both, it's a tax. We see guys like Casey could say, well, we haven't increased taxes. You've increased fees.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, a fee is a tax. Republicans do this all the time. Well, we cut taxes, but you raised fees. They just changed the law to allow the local Department of Motor Vehicles, Bureau of Motor Vehicles, to raise fees. Why? supposedly to get more people in there. Bet me it doesn't happen. You're still going to wait. If you go at noon on a Tuesday to go get your driver's license renewed, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to be in there for 2 hours. So this is the kind of nonsense that's out there. And what's happening is these fees and taxes and things that are costing business, especially in Ohio. Ohio's not a friendly place to do business. It used to be, but it hasn't been for decades. Republicans who were supposedly coming in to dismantle a lot of the stuff that Vern Reif and the boys did during the 60s and 70s and early 80s, it just didn't happen. They basically picked up the mantle and just did it differently. They didn't dismantle it. And that's the problem. One of the things that got Donald Trump elected. The whole MAGA, M-A-G-A, Make America Great Again, he was going to dismantle. Now, he's only 100 days in, so I mean, nobody's a miracle worker. His first budget does not even take effect until October. A lot of people don't understand that. When a president comes in, he's still operating on the last guy's budget. And he does mm-hmm. so until October, because October 1st is the first year of the fiscal year, the first day of the fiscal year. So basically, there's going to have to be a massive dismantling. And unfortunately, this is one of those situations, Barry, where I've said this over and over and over again: you cannot mm-hmm. unbuild a dam in a day.
Yeah, it's true.
If you just go through and start wildly swinging and cutting things out instead of doing them in a sort of an ordered manner and say, as of this date, you know, be prepared because as of this date, you're losing this benefit.
Yeah.
The state will no longer provide this. The state will no longer do this. The state will, you have to give people warning. You can't just go in and say, oh, by the way, we cut all that out and it's done. Because at that point, you create essentially a revolt. If you go through and say, we have to dismantle this because there's no money. People kind of grasp that. Now, the people who are on the dole don't grasp it because all of a sudden it becomes clear that the dole is over. You know, are there people that legitimately need help? Yes. Do they necessarily need help from the state? Well, no. Joel McDermott, a guy that we know from American Vision, wrote a great book called, Restoring America One County at a Time?
Yeah, Restoring America One County at a Time. That's right.
In which he talks about the fact that the counties at the government level need to step in, and really it needs to be private entities like churches who need to step in and take up that slack. Now, the reason churches don't do it now, because in the past, when churches did do those things, people tithed. And the reason they tithed was because the government was not taking 40% of their income.
Mm-hmm.
So they had the money to tithe and continue to live at a decent, you know, living level. But the fact is that the churches operated welfare agencies they were called tithe agencies. They were called that because
that's exactly what they're
people
called.
Tithe, and among those agencies that were run on church tithes were hospitals. Now, again, we've lamented the fact that all the church hospitals are now basically run by for-profit corporations. In most cases, not making them better, making it ridiculously more difficult and more expensive to have what should be fairly routine procedures done, and part of that has to do with costs related to paperwork and bureaucracy, and part having to do with a cost related to malpractice because. Let's face it, every time somebody has a treatment for something, there's a risk. There's a risk for going in and have open heart surgery. There's a risk for having any kind of surgery. Now, if a doctor legitimately makes a mistake that is due to negligence or malfeasance, then he should be forced to pay for that mistake. If something is due to the risk and all due diligence was done and nothing really could have been done to save that, should that doctor then have the fault of, have that ticked against him as a fault and be forced to pay a patient who basically suffered from one of the possible consequences of having to have the surgery? I don't think so.
Yeah, probably not.
I don't think so. Look, how many times have we had cases? There's other cases in tort reform. I've known people who basically got knocked off a motorcycle. This is a case I heard about in, it's got to be 30 plus years ago for a company I worked for. There was a guy who had a degree in a medical field. And I asked him why he wasn't practicing what he'd gone to school for. And he goes, well, I got hit from behind on a motorcycle. And I'm suing that person for removing my livelihood. He goes, as soon as I win that suit, I'll go back into practice. And I said, well, I thought you said you couldn't practice your livelihood. And he goes, no, I'm just trying to collect for this accident.
Yeah.
There we go, folks. That's part of the problem. That's part of a hunk of the problem. The guy knew he was fully capable of practicing his medical art, but chose not to so he could make money. So he was going to pay off his student loans with the money that he collected from this accident. Now, should the person who hit him from behind have to pay something? Yeah, I think so. There should be a punishment involved. Should it be tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars on a fraudulent claim? No, I don't think so. I think that's a major problem. Look, that just marks a major problem that's rampant throughout society. Everybody decides they're going to get what they got coming one way or another.
Yep. That's the way it works.
We got way off the topic on that, but
No, that's perfectly fine. I think that we need to, we need to look at this stuff and we need to figure out how this all fits in.
Yeah, cuz it is all pieces of a puzzle. We've got government who's basically stepping in and buying votes, because let's face it, John Kasich was buying votes. You alluded to it with the thing about Cleveland. He pumped money into the Cleveland area. John Kasich was buying votes with welfare expansion.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how successful was that? Well, nobody's done any studies or anything. I doubt if it was particularly successful.
It's hard to say. I mean, the point is that what they did with the Medicaid expansion is they underestimated, and I think intentionally, the numbers that would actually sign up once you expanded it.
Exactly.
And of course, what happened was there was a flood that was 40% greater than what they had calculated and anticipated. So what happens, Chuck, when you get 40% more people saying, "Hey, I want a piece of that"?
Well, you get 40%.
And of course, since you promised minimum, so what do you do with that?
Yeah, it's 40% more in cost.
Yeah,
if not more, and yep, probably more. It's going to cost you way more money than you anticipated. And here's the bad part. I'm guessing that when they issued the report about what it was going to cost, They threw in a wide margin of error, and everybody went with the low end of the margin.
Probably so.
Saying, look, we can do it for this. I've seen this particular kind of mentality, for instance, in a church building project I was involved in.
Ooh, yeah, that can get a little ugly.
Well, it did. By like $500,000, it got ugly. An extra $500,000, in other words, an extra 25% of the cost of the original cost of the building. People would come in and say, we would love to have this. One of the contractors said, we would love to have this. I can get it done. I've already looked into it. I can get it done for this much. Well, when the actual job got done, it cost 40% more. Why? Well, because they, you know, they got a lowball bid and the costs ran up more. Foundation issues, and it required permit changes, and it required contractors to come in and change the way things were done, which required other things to change. And so what happens? It looks like something that looked like it might cost you $30,000 and ended up costing you $45,000. Well, you add those up, you get 10 of those, and suddenly you're $150,000 to the bad.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's exactly what's basically gone on here. It's incompetence.
Yeah.
It's either incompetence or it's basically whistling past the graveyard.
Well, there's a lot of that that goes on.
Yeah, because again, the way politics works right now, you have to buy votes. Or they think they have to buy votes. In other words, they have to appease this group, that group, another group. At whose expense? Well, at the expense of the middle class. Because again, most of the revenue, as always, comes from the middle class.
Yeah.
It always does. And you can't get it by raising taxes on the rich, because as we just discussed, raising taxes on the rich kills investment. So what do you do at this point? Well, the only thing you can do is retrench. That's the bottom line. You can only retrench, and retrenching means cutting costs. How do you cut costs? You start cutting services and benefits. Now, what's that mean? What's your most expensive part of running any government agency? What's the most expensive part? Is it the actual benefits?
No, it's the administration of the benefits.
It's the administration of the benefits. So what's going to happen? A lot of state people are going to have to lose their jobs. This is a prediction, folks, by the way. This is how they're going to have to cut state agencies. That's the only way around it. Either that or raise taxes. And right now, I don't think the mood is there. Anybody who touches that third rail at this point is going to feel the consequences of touching a third rail, which is a deep shock and possibly, most likely, a fatal shock. Fatal not to them personally, but to their political career. Now, what does that do? It lends itself to demagoguery. You're going to see in the next gubernatorial election, you're going to see the politics of envy. We've got to raise taxes on those who are more able to pay. We've got to. Otherwise, we lose all these benefits and we lose all these state employees, which we can't lose.
No, wrong. I think that's where the cuts need to start, is cutting these extraneous entitlement programs and cutting the state government. Frankly, Chuck, I mean, that's one of the things that there are many members in the legislature, they are looking at the idea of, do we really have too many state employees? And the answer is, yeah, we do.
Well, of course we do, yeah.
As a matter of fact, because every time the economy downturns in the private sector, where do people head? They go find government jobs.
Exactly. You go
try. Seem to be plentiful, because as agencies have people applying, they turn and they start asking the legislature to expand their budget so that they can hire more people.
Well, what's the first thing? I mean, we talked about, if you go back and check our show archives, which are all available at www.principledpolicy.com, and when we talked about Medicaid expansion, you said, what's it going to have to do at the state employee level? That's going to require a massive bureaucracy.
Oh, and it does. As a matter of fact, there's probably at least three different agents. Oh, no, excuse me, now two, because they combined one. Department of Medicaid, Department of Health Transformations combined, or at least they're planning on being combined under this budget. and the Department of Job and Family Services, but then you got the Department of Health. You've got all of these agencies and cabinet offices that all have to have their fingers in it. And usually that means you're going to get a lot of redundancies, a lot of duplication of effort, and a lot of waste.
You don't say. Government waste? Whoever heard of that?
I know, that's an oxymoron. I get that. Okay.
You know, once the problem is this is the law of unintended consequences.
Writ large.
Now, John Kasich, I think, honestly, had it all worked out, this is the tremendous ego of the man. John Kasich had it all worked out that he wouldn't have to deal with this because he'd be sitting either in the president's or the vice president's seat.
Well, possibly so, yes.
The big plan, he had it all worked out. And now here's what's really happening. He's doing his best to make the legislature stand there holding the bag on this, which in part they are.
Yeah, they are. I mean, in part. But, you know, that's the reason why there's not a whole lot of love lost right now between the legislature and the governor. And the reason why, even before the announcement that they had to come up with $400 million per year in cuts, that chairmen of subcommittees are reporting back hundreds of millions of dollars in cuts to Kasich's proposal. They're not putting up with it anymore, Chuck. I mean, they've had it.
Well, look,
they know he's on the way out, and they're the ones that are on the hook. If this thing goes south, he will wander off into that good night of, you know, going on the chicken dinner circuit or being the talking head on Fox. I hear that they may have an opening for one of their programs here really soon.
Looks like Bill O'Reilly's on getting ready to let the doorknob hit him on the way out.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. And so there's going to be an opening at Fox News. Maybe the governor will go back over to his old stomping grounds and pick up the O'Reilly program.
Well,
maybe call it the O'Reilly program.
I like that. The O'Reilly program.
Yeah, O'Reilly? Yeah. you're going to be president? O'Reilly?
Yeah. See what kind of inanities that Kasich utters on the air and say, O'Reilly?
Exactly.
With the viewer. Yeah. He probably would head back to Fox or very possibly someplace like CNN. The way he has comported himself during his governorship, he looked like more like he was auditioning for a trial at CNN rather than at Fox News, although Fox News is bad enough on its own. I've always told people said, oh, it's great to have conservative news channel. I go, what are you talking about? I said, they're center left, as opposed to CNN, which is like progressive far left.
Which is left.
Yeah. I said, you're talking conservative only in a relative sense. Fox News was never, I mean, all you got to do is, who's one of their big talking heads? It's Shep Smith. Well, Shepard Smith is hardly anything like a conservative.
No,
and never has been. Yeah, they have had people who, and they've broomed them out. You got Sean Hannity, but I don't count him for anything. I'll be quite honest. He's not a deep thinker by any stretch of the imagination. But that being said, yeah, Kasich will not starve.
No, not at all.
No, he'll do punditry from someplace else. It sort of makes you wonder what would have happened to somebody like, you and I both supported Ken Blackwell for governor, and from the things I've seen out of him, we would have been so much better off with Ken Blackwell than with John Kasich.
Yeah, that's true. And again, the Blackwell situation was he ran against Ted Strickland in 2006 and lost. And then 4 years into Strickland's administration, people were so fed up with the liberal Democrat policies that anything looked good to them. So that's when John Kasich rose.
Yeah, essentially. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm going to make a statement. Ken Blackwell fell victim to racism. And I don't like to make that charge too much, in large part.
Okay, well, let me confirm that charge for you. I worked Ken's campaign Full disclosure, I was the social outreach coordinator for groups all over the state, and there were pockets in certain parts of the state, and I'm not going to say where, but there were pockets that the, shall we say, backwards thinking was so prevalent, it was palpable. And people understand probably where I'm talking about, but that was a big, between that dynamic and the dynamic of the establishment Republican class, who were so upset that Blackwell had been this upstart who didn't know his place, and I say that in that same sense, that didn't know his place, and so therefore they were going to punish him by having the Jim Petro wing of the Republican Party, which is who he ran against in that primary, basically not only didn't vote for him in the general, many of them created an entity called Republicans for Ted Strickland.
Yep.
They went over actively and courted the other side, which I think you would have... John Kasich just doesn't have enough guts to do so, but he all but went over to endorse Hillary Clinton when Donald Trump got the nomination from him.
Well, when he comes out and publicly says he voted for a man who, for which he knew full well his vote did not count.
Right.
John McCain. He voted for John McCain, who has not acquitted himself well in the first days of the Trump presidency.
No, and we've talked about that on other programs. It's been very embarrassing. I feel sorry for John McCain because, you know, he did serve his country. He had, at one point, he had respectability, but he's basically let that all run like water down the drain.
Yeah. I don't know how much respect. I mean, he was early in either his first or second term when he got caught up in that whole ab scam, nonsense, people taking shoeboxes full of money, from FBI agents posing as Arab, as agents of, Saudi Arabia, I think, and oil money. I'm trying to remember the details. Remember, this is back in 1984, 83, somewhere around in there. So that tells you how long these guys are around.
Yeah, and that may be a big part of the problem, too, is that after a while they start believing that that's where they deserve to be.
Yes.
And then the attitude shifts.
Well, I can tell you this. John McCain was the only Republican caught up in the ab scam.
Okay. All right. So there was that. I had forgotten about his role in ab scam. I mean, we've had Gang of Eight. We've had... Okay, now that I'm thinking about it, I did go too far in giving him too much credit. He did serve his country. He did serve as a prisoner of war. For that, we give him thanks.
Yes.
But his political career has been basically downhill.
Yes, it's not been done well.
Yeah, let's just modify that statement.
Well, who joined him in the Gang of Eight? It was Mike DeWine.
Mike DeWine.
Mike DeWine,
who wants
to run for governor. Folks, think about these things. Go back and look at some of these guys. Seriously. The Republican Party keeps throwing these terrible candidates at us. And what they do is triangulate it so they broom all the real conservatives out. This has been a problem with... this is why I'm an opponent, and people are always looking at me like I've got smoke coming out of my ears. I'm an opponent of term limits, because what the parties do is they simply wait out these guys. If they're popular in their district, they wait the true conservatives. They wait out. Mm-hmm. And when they're term limited out, they do not endorse them for another office. They do not allow them to switch seats with someone in the other house. For instance, if you're in the Ohio House of Representatives, very often what they do is they let you switch seats with someone who's in the Senate. They endorse you, and especially if it's in a safe district, they endorse you and support you and give you all the money you need, so that then you serve there until your term's over, and then you swap them back when those terms are over. When you're a conservative with the Ohio Republican Party, you don't get that. you got to claw your way back into office after sitting out a term. And it's not easy. You got to walk a district. You basically got to knock one of the GOPE guys out.
Or in some instances, you get blessed because you end up in a district that when you're out, they can't hold the seat. A Democrat takes it. And then you get the opportunity of coming back in and trying to regain the seat for the party.
And we've known guys that this has happened to.
I know guys who've done that. So.
Yeah. So basically what I'm saying is, yes, the Ohio Republican Party actively works to get rid of truly conservative candidates who would not have, by the way, given John Kasich exactly what he wanted for the last 6 years, which is what has happened with the Republican Party since John Kasich took office. They gave him everything he wanted. Now it's blowing up in their face and they're mad at him. Well, whose fault is it?
Mm-hmm.
It's yours. Barry, let's talk about constitutionalism for a minute, both at the federal and the state level. We always hear these stories when we take civics in school that we have three co-equal branches of government, both at the state and the federal level. Is that true? That's right. We need to get a buzzer. Sorry. We need to get a buzzer sound and insert it. I need to get a little button I can press and just automatically puts an in there because that's wrong. Where is the balance of power in constitutional republics like we have in the United States of America?
The balance of power sits mainly with the lawmaking branch, which is the Congress.
The legislature always has the balance of power. Now, people always say, that's not true because blah, blah, blah. They'll give me, president can do this and this and this and this. I go, show me in the Constitution where the president has the power to do that particular thing
exactly.
That you just gave it to. Show it to me. Well, it's in the umbras and penumbras and blah, blah, blah. I go, don't give me the umbras and penumbras. If it's not written down explicitly, he doesn't have that power. And how can I say that? Read the 9th and the 10th Amendment. Read it.
Yep.
It essentially says that we weren't kidding. We want a literal translation of this particular document. Okay. How do I know the legislature, at least at the federal level for sure, has more power? Well, who impanels judges?
Well, impaneling judges at the federal level, it's a nomination by the President of the United States and confirmation by the Senate.
Yeah. If it was just nomination by the President, who would be sitting in the ninth seat of the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, right now?
Oh, Merrick Garland. Because
Merrick Garland.
And who Obama would have wanted.
And the screams and chest beating, if you recall, that was a stolen seat. No, it wasn't, because normally when a Supreme Court justice dies in the last year of a president's term, he doesn't even pick anybody. Because it's generally considered that the next president will be the one who gets to fill that seat. That's not a constitutional requirement, but it is a longstanding precedent. What a shock. Barack Obama threw cold water in the face of a longstanding precedent. Nothing new there. Okay, that being said, okay, so we now know that the Senate actually impanels the Supreme Court justices and other court justices at the federal level as well. Those all have to go through Senate confirmation. Okay, now, what is the power in the Constitution that makes me know that the federal courts are under the jurisdiction mostly of the Senate, of the House and the Senate, and the legislature?
Well, there's a provision in relation to the fact that the judges of all courts, including the United States Supreme Court, serve their terms during good behavior.
Good behavior.
And that there is removal, including impeachment procedures, that are taken up by the legislature. Impeachment begins in the House, and trials for impeachment are handled in the Senate.
So basically, they can be seated and unseated by the legislature.
And as well as every court except the United States Supreme Court, which is a constitutionally mandated court. Any federal court, whether it's circuit court or district courts, are from time to time established by the legislature.
That's right.
And that means that there is a definite beginning and a definite can be a definite end to those inferior courts. That from time to time means doesn't mean from the beginning when they establish them till time immemorial when the entire planet collapses. That means that Congress can basically break up, restructure, or eliminate a federal court.
Yep.
And whether it's a district court or an entire circuit. And there have been rumblings about breaking up the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and getting rid of its large sway over the country.
Exactly. The Ninth Circuit tomorrow could be eliminated and simply replaced, which means that all the judges that sit on that circuit lose their jobs. Sorry, yep. guys, there is Correct. No Ninth Circuit anymore. It's now the they could skip the number 9 and go right over to the next set of numbers and say, well, the Ninth Circuit just simply does not exist. Okay, there's another provision, and that is that liberals love to call it, give it a bad name, or what they think is a bad name. It's called jurisdiction what do they call it? Jurisdiction stripping. Jurisdiction stripping.
Right. And that's a constitutional provision as well.
Yes.
That the Congress, just by a simple vote of, they can put a provision in law by a simple, it doesn't even need to be a supermajority, no filibuster proof, blah, 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 simple majority, that basically can take away everything except the enumerated powers of a court. So if it's not a case that falls in one of the enumerated areas that the Supreme Court has either original jurisdiction or has original jurisdiction in, the Congress can say, you don't have any authority to hear it, period.
Yeah.
The only ones they can't touch are that small list in Article 3 where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction over. That's it.
And that's interstate lawsuits and suits involving foreign countries and suits involving ambassadors and maritime law. And that's pretty much it. Okay, now I'm going to go over to the executive branch. What power does the executive branch itself have over Congress? What provisions are there in the Constitution that give it any power at all over Congress?
Veto power over legislation. That's it.
Veto power, and what can the legislature do to the veto?
They can overturn it.
Override it. That's right. They can override a veto. If 2/3 of them say nope, you're usurping our authority, we're going to overturn that. And they can. They can. Now, what else can the legislature do? Let's turn it back. What can the legislature do to the executive branch?
The legislature can do a number of things to the executive branch, including impeachment of a president.
Bingo.
Overriding a veto. Denying him his cabinet picks.
Bingo.
Impeaching federal officers that he puts in place in cabinet offices.
Yep.
Restructuring and eliminating cabinet offices.
Yeah, exactly. So where does the balance of power lie?
Oh, it's co-equal branches of government.
Yeah, I mean, we just walked you through basically Civics 101 that a lot of people study for, yeah, or shall we say, are misinformed on during their entire senior year in high school.
Oh, dude, it goes through much more than that.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember in junior high school in discussing
Civics,
it, you always heard, you know, hey, and think about it. I don't remember exactly, but Schoolhouse Rock, isn't there something in there? I mean, maybe Schoolhouse Rock might have gotten it more closely right, because most of the things is centered around the ability of Congress to pass bills.
Yeah, I'm still just a bill. If you remember that little Schoolhouse Rock thing with the little bill sitting on the steps of Congress, and all the steps it had to go through. Yeah, so there are all kinds of things that the legislature can do that neither the president nor the courts can do. Now, the courts have usurped a lot of authority, and the executive branch has usurped a lot of authority. And the Congress, one of the cries that you'll hear from this program, and we're one of the voices crying in the wilderness, is do your job and take back your authority. During the entire Obama presidency, and during a huge portion of the Bush presidency, and during the Clinton presidency, I personally was saying, look, all Congress has to do is simply take that authority back. They already have it.
Mm-hmm.
exercise it. There's nothing we can do. How many times do we hear John Boehner say, well, there's nothing we can do?
Well, and think about this too, Chuck, because you and I talked offline that there's a member of Congress who is proposing something that actually is Congress's authority to do, but he's kicking it out to a special blue ribbon panel.
This is one of the things that people who don't like the way the Constitution works try to do things. There's a lawmaker, and we're going to be out of time before we can get too far into this, but it's something you need to know about. Representative Earl Blumenauer out of Oregon, a Democrat out of Oregon, House of Representatives, the United States House of Representatives, has proposed a bill to modify the 25th Amendment, which is how presidents can be removed if they are incapable of doing the job. For instance, some health issue, mental health, physical health, or he has a breakdown of some kind, that he can be removed currently through the agreement of the cabinet and the vice president, who petitioned Congress. Again, the power goes back to Congress, and Congress says, yeah, you can, yeah, he's out. Or the president himself can say, I am too ill to do the job, please remove. And in some cases, it can be a temporary thing. For instance, if the president falls into a coma after an accident, it could be temporary. If he recovers from the thing, he can go back and do the job. Okay, this Representative Earl Blumenauer wants to make this no longer the prerogative of the cabinet, because after all, the president appoints the cabinet, and they might see it his way. If he's behaving badly, they might see it his way. What he wants to do is turn it over, this power over, to a sitting panel of former presidents and vice presidents. So, in other words, he wants to turn it over to the likes of, to quote an article that I read in the Conservative Tribune, because the cabinet can be fired by the president, there is a natural bias that would make them reluctant to acknowledge the president's inability to serve. It's time to revisit and strengthen the amendment and make sure there is a reliable mechanism in place if the president becomes unable to discharge the powers and duties of office. In other words, Blumenauer would rather have Donald Trump's ability to remain in office decided by a panel that includes Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Al Gore, Joe Biden, Walter Mondale, and two members of the Bush family, a clan not known for its warm relations with the Trump team, instead of the constitutionally mandated process by which the cabinet and vice president make that decision. There you have it.
I love it. It's great. That's a make work program for Democrats who can't find work.
Well, in case you don't understand exactly what's going on here, Blumenauer basically makes it clear by saying, quote, the erratic behavior of Donald Trump has raised new questions about his mental and emotional capacity to discharge the tremendous burdens of the most powerful position in the world, Blumenauer wrote in a February op-ed for Oregon Live. So this is part of that media drumbeat. He's incapable. He shouldn't be allowed to do this. We don't like the way he's acting. In other words, he's not acting the way we think he should act. In other words, like the previous president. And therefore, we want to remove him from office by using this panel of essentially partisans.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it sounds like a good idea, folks, you really need to really closely examine the motivations of people who have these cockamamie ideas.
And just as a quick aside, I know we're running out of time, but as a quick aside, this is just part and parcel with the Democrats because, well, they can't win it electorally, and the Georgia 6th District race last night showed that, as their guy that they pumped $30 million into and had all kinds of Hollywood stars sending in radio ads and emails and get out the votes, John Ossoff, failed to avoid a runoff to take the seat of Tom Price, and now it looks like the Democrats have gone and lost to Donald Trump again in the congressional election.
Because a runoff is almost a for certain loss.
Win for the Republican because of the way the district shaped.
Yeah. Okay, that being said, we're out of time, and thanks for putting up with our rantings and ravings this week. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.